Hey, and welcome to the Hashtag Angels podcast, where we bring you conversations about the latest tech trends and the people inventing and shaping them. I'm Jana Messerschmidt, and this week I'm joined by my co-host and fellow Hashtag Angel, Chloe Sladen.
No wonder they're not getting pregnant. It would be really hard to get pregnant with a doctor in the room for 6 to 12 months.
And we sit down with Tammy Sun.
Pick where you're going to work based on like who you're around, because like you never know, like your colleagues today could be your co-founders tomorrow.
Tammy is the co-founder of Carrot, a tech-centric fertility benefits company that we've backed at Hashtag Angels. Today, we talk about our own personal fertility journeys and how Tammy's own journey led her to become a founder and build Carrot. We'll also talk about how the space could evolve in the coming decades. We'll then talk about how employee mafia networks are the best support systems. All right, let's get started.
It's about time.
Yes. If only we had more time.
We have so many other awesome projects going on.
So Tammy, thank you so much for joining us on the Hashtag Angels pod. We are so excited to have you. You know, full disclosure, we are investors in Tammy's company, Carrot. I believe we were actually the first money to hit your bank account back in like 2015, 2016.
Yes. I mean, what a journey it is. I'm so happy to be here with you all. So thanks for having me.
Well, we are excited to talk a little bit more about you. You know, you have such an interesting background, having started off kind of grown up in the political sphere and in government, and then making this transition over to tech. Maybe talk a little bit about the journey from working in the Clinton White House to then working at the Clinton Foundation and then making the jump over to tech.
You know, when I first started thinking about starting this company, I didn't know anything, right? I didn't know anyone. Like, I didn't know that there was such a thing as, you know, EIRs that you could go and park yourself at and do a bunch of research and someone would pay you and all of that stuff. And so I think when I look back at that transition and that period of time, I'm going to talk about like how important it was that, that I met you all and your backing and your conviction super, super early, before this category was really thought to be a category at all. Mm-hmm. I mean, I really didn't intend to start this company at all. I moved to California to work at Evernote, and, you know, had transitioned from politics and policy and government. And I do think that there's a lot of similar traits and attributes, between, you know, people who work in government and policy and politics and people who work in tech. I think they're both just different ways to think about platforms for impacting change at scale. And I think, you know, so they're just sort of two sides of the same coin. So I see a lot of similarities in like the types of people and what people are motivated by and, you know, how they think about their life's work. So, that transition came in, I think, like 2014, 2015, and, you know, was really excited about the opportunity to work at Evernote and started from there.
I'm curious, when did you first get the idea or the inkling that you wanted to start Carrot? And maybe tell us a little bit about just what Carrot is.
You know, I was working and had decided to freeze my eggs at the time. And this was just after egg freezing had become non-experimental as a procedure in the U.S. And realized as I was going through that process that I would have to pay for it myself out of pocket. My insurance card was rejected. It wasn't covered by my health plan. And I guess it was naively surprising to me that that was the case because, you know, I had never really been sick. I had never, you know, taxed the health plan in any way. I'd never asked for anything. I'd sort of paid my premiums. I never really asked anything from my healthcare coverage other than sort of, you know, basic checkups and stuff. And then I was really surprised and disappointed that at a moment when me and I imagined like many other women wanted access to fertility healthcare, that it was all of a sudden sort of oh no, that's not included. Like that's outside and that's your responsibility to have to pay for. And so I was surprised and disappointed and frustrated, and started really looking into the fertility category and the space. And I was so energized by all of the sort of scientific advancements that I had started learning about in terms of, you know, just where the technology was for fertility care at a clinical and a medical level. So, you know, started exploring that and really thought that I was going to start a consumer company. Mm-hmm. And my co-founder is a fertility doctor. She's a U.S. board certified REI. And so we sort of had this concept that we understood the patient perspective from a 360 view and would develop something, you know, for consumers.
I still remember that first time that we all sat together. I think it was like 2015, 2016. It was actually at the Twitter office. You mm-hmm. came over. And we were whiteboarding and we were talking about just how broken the consumer journey was. And all of us had gone through it. We were actually just chatting within hashtag angels. All six of us have gone through either egg freezing or IVF or some combination of those things. And, you know, I think for so many people going through it, there's just such a lack of information and data, and you're just kind of flying blind through the whole thing. And I remember that just like really grabbed me when we first started chatting of just like, how could we make this a much better experience for anybody going through it?
Yeah, I remember that. And, you know, I remember that office, you know, in the Twitter building, and we were just thinking it through and sharing stories about, you know, how difficult every aspect of the of that patient journey was. But one of the things that I think we all recognized early on is that we in that room were all very, very lucky that we had, you know, money, essentially, like that we had savings, that we had access to cash and capital so that we could pay for the mm-hmm. fertility healthcare that we all needed. And as you all know, that's not the case for all, you know, for most Americans. Most Americans don't have $500 in a savings account, and they don't have, you know, a paycheck to fall back on. And so, as we were thinking through that, and I remember I still had a job at that point, mm-hmm. like a full time job. As we were thinking through that, I remember these thoughts sort of coming out very clearly, and thinking, "Wow, like the real pain point for consumers, the real pain point for patients is affordability."
I remember that conversation so well because, like you, Tammy, I had frozen my eggs very early on. Literally, mm-hmm. I had been talking to my gynecologist about, so when is egg freezing available? Because I remember Sex and the City episodes from like, you know, 20 years ago where it was like, we're all freezing our eggs. And so I would ask my gynecologist every now and then. She'd be like, no, nope. And then finally, one time I asked, she's like, yep, now you could do it. And so it's interesting. We think about tech as... and the money in tech and angel investing and technology, you know, this is a place where because of both the technology and the access to funding, we can try all these new things. And in some ways, what I found so inspiring about our first conversation, those first conversations with you, was each of us was using our money. Literally, I was using money from a Twitter tender offer to go and invest in this brand new technology of vitrification of eggs. To extend my fertility options. I was dating my now husband at the time. And for me, it wasn't about slowing down fertility for work, which is, mm-hmm. I think a lot of people assume that's what it is. Actually, right. The majority reason why women freeze their eggs, which is separate from IVF, is to give them fertility preservation and better options in choosing a partner. Mm-hmm. Because choosing a partner, we have much higher expectations. So, you know, he and I did it together as a thing of, you know, sort of saying, well, look, if we end up together, this extends our fertility road if we need it. And if we don't end up together, I won't hate you for the rest of my life.
Yeah. Yeah. I remember this. Yeah.
Right. And so that's one point around like why people choose egg freezing. But when you and Jana and I got together to talk, it was this amazing moment of, this is a technology frontier. This is a cultural frontier. This is an ethical frontier. Mm-hmm. And no, there isn't enough data or money in it. And so all three of us were like, we are using, I mean, I specifically told my fertility doctor, you know, I was like, by the way, I'm not here for fertility. Like, for all I know, I'm fertile. Mm-hmm. I'm here for fertility preservation. And they had no concept. They didn't even know they put me through as if I was having fertility issues.
Yeah.
So first of all, the consumer experience didn't even match my goals.
Yeah.
And that conversation was all about, how do we look at this space that has been closed off and made so sort of, and I'll share a specific story around this, made so like the provenance of doctors and not of women, or at least not a shared, there wasn't a shared stakeholder effort. It was very, I felt condescending and paternalistic. Mm-hmm. And you were coming in and saying, not only is the consumer experience broken, but it needs all this infrastructure to actually open up this field of fertility choice and fertility preservation and bring women in and men in as stakeholders, anyone who wants to have children. And I just love that you had this vision for creating everything from a marketplace to a vertically integrated solution. And you had such a bold vision. It was literally like, how do we turn this challenge women face, and men to a much lesser extent, mostly young women, which is this biological clock that is ticking, that is not, you know, our physical bodies are not evolving at the pace of our brains, our culture, and our work opportunities, or our family, you know, set up, right? And how do we take this liability and actually turn it into something that could be, if anything, almost a financial instrument for women? If you freeze your eggs when you're very young, you'll get a ton of eggs. They can be yours if you choose not to have children, or if you choose to have children but not use them, or you don't need all of them. Now you have an asset that you could either donate, sell, you know, et cetera. Like suddenly it was this flip of this thing that I think we've all grown up feeling this pressure. And you were saying, how do we actually take that pressure and through science, technology, and ethics, turn that into an asset? And I love that. That was such a phenomenal way of approaching the whole opportunity.
In my mind today, it's about human equality and human potential, right? And the unlocking of all human beings and their potential. And I think the biggest misconception that people often bring to Carrot and to me is that Carrot is, you know, very pro kids, pro families, pro having kids, and it's about family building. And it is in a lot of ways. Having children can be a byproduct of how people use our product, right? But it's also more than that. In my mind, it's about giving women and all people the tools, the technology, the assets, the opportunity to design their lives in the way that they think maximizes their human potential. For some people, maximizing your human potential is about being a mom or being a parent. And so, for some people, it's about waiting another 10 years. For other people, it's about, you know, this other thing. And, I think that these are the choices that really will either, you know, limit or expand how we are as human beings in our brief time on this planet. And I think that's really like where the value is, right? How do we make these critical decisions in a way that maximizes our humanness?
You know, I remember, I think it was Chloe who said this after one of those first like jamming sessions, was egg freezing is going to be the greatest basically equalizer for women since birth control. And that has always stuck with me. So this idea that like everyone could have the same optionality of how they think about families throughout the course of their lives is just so powerful.
I think COVID has really brought this issue to light in a really new way. When we first met and people were talking and thinking about fertility preservation technology or egg freezing, you know, it was in a context of a pretty limited sort of case, right? The sort of stereotypical, typical, the idea of a woman who's working on her career and is delaying having children and, you know, is doing this for that reason. And I think what we have seen over the past few years is that's not the only sort of way that people use Carrot and people use egg freezing. I see married couples freezing eggs. I see married couples, you know, freezing embryos, I see more and more men looking at fertility preservation through semen freezing and sperm freezing. But I also think that the past year has been super interesting in my own thinking about sort of the future of fertility as a category, insofar as, to your point, Jana, about thinking about how you're going to time your relationships and time your life, I think more and more younger people are going to think about their healthcare resiliency, particularly mm-hmm. those that have been super impacted by COVID-19 and really have are coming of age, whatever that means, right? You're in your 20s or maybe your 30s, coming of age and sort of having been hit by this pandemic. I think there will be an emerging sense of healthcare resiliency that will span across lots of areas of healthcare. But the way that it will impact fertility is like, well, what is my fertility resilience like plan? Like, what is my fertility mm-hmm. like redundancy plan, right? And thinking about, okay, the future is always uncertain. Maybe, as you said, maybe I'll be divorced. Maybe we'll break up. Maybe there will be a global pandemic that will inhibit my ability to achieve pregnancy or meet a partner or whatever it is. And so I do think that this technology is coming to the fore at a time where younger people are going to really start thinking about their healthcare resiliency in a lot of different ways and deploying this technology for to increase their healthcare resilience rather than, oh, I'm just, you know, I fit this type of person and therefore that's why I'm freezing my eggs.
Definitely. I'm curious, like you're sitting on top of the data. Are you seeing during COVID, are people using fertility benefits more? Are they using them less?
Yeah, there's been a huge spike in egg freezing, perhaps unsurprisingly.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Why do you think that is?
I think that people are thinking about the ways that they pursue parenthood a lot differently, you know, in February 2020 versus February 2021. You know, plans change, life happens. And I think people want some sort of alternative path to pursue parenthood as an option in the future.
Well, I think I saw like this amazing meme that was basically during the pandemic, a lot of first babies would be mm-hmm. born, but not many like second or third.
Yeah.
Because anybody who was quarantined with children were like, nope.
Yes. Yes. Well, I mean, I do think COVID, you know, for the caregiving space has been an amazing resetting and sort of a lifting of the veil of how poorly we support caregivers mm-hmm. in this country. Everything from, you know, the fact that we don't have a federal paid leave policy for whether mm-hmm. you're sick, you're caregiving for a sick family member, or you're, you know, a new parent. The fact that we don't have universal free pre-K support, mm-hmm. you know, childcare before kindergarten. I think I'm not surprised that we're going to have a baby bust. In fact, I was listening to a podcast about child seats, and they found a study's correlated a drop in third children being born because you can't fit three bloody car seats in the back of a car. Literally, car seat lady, you know, Google car seat lady if you are having three kids to figure out which cars will fit. A Bolt works, by the way, a big plug for the Bolt. But anyhow, part of that podcast was saying that they were expecting post-COVID a big baby bust. And I bet mm-hmm. it will be all second and third children because mm-hmm. the first babies are probably mm-hmm. still coming. But it is interesting. I can imagine this past year, parenting has been revealed. You know, there's so much myth-making and lack of transparency around this whole process of you know, becoming a parent, whether it's fertility and, you know, miscarriage mm-hmm. and childbirth. Like, none of us witnessed childbirth. Like, isn't that crazy that it's one of the most profound physical experiences you go through, and the vast majority of us aren't in the room before we give birth to see a birth, mm-hmm. Which I think is a very modern thing. But yeah, I think this past year, parenting has been revealed to be really in its full glory of struggle and beauty, and maybe a little more struggle for the past 18 months than beauty.
But all its glory and all its goriness.
And all its goriness, exactly. Yeah. So I'm not surprised I'll be a baby bust. So I'm glad. I mean, this is what's so interesting about fertility. Like you were saying, Carrot isn't just about supporting having children. It's about choices. Mm-hmm. And some of that choice might be, I don't want to raise my own child or have a child, but I'm happy for my genetic material to enable another family to do that or another person to do that in the way they want. And I think that's such a beautiful vision.
Yeah. Tammy, I'm curious, talk a little bit more about what Carrot actually is mm-hmm. and how you've built the company here over the last 4 or 5 years.
Yeah. So, I mean, you know, we've talked a lot about sort of equalizing, you know, the world and making sure that people have these choices. But the real sort of first existential problem that has to be tackled, in my view, in order to make that true, is to make it a part of healthcare. You know, more than 150 million Americans get their healthcare in this country through their jobs. And so whether, you know, whatever your philosophical agreements or disagreements are about how healthcare should be designed, like that is the truth. And that is how the country is set up for the foreseeable future. People get employer-sponsored healthcare, whether it's fully insured or self-funded plans. And so what we believe is that fertility should be a standard part of healthcare, just like medical, dental, and vision. And so if we want to make that true, then we had to figure out a way to partner with employers. And that's essentially what we do, is we work with employers to give them a software solution that allows them to design and easily implement fertility benefits for employees in the U.S. or 50 countries around the world. And where I have just been so heartened over the past few years is, you know, when we first started, it was like fertility benefits for all people, regardless of age, race, sex, sexual orientation, gender identity, expression, marital status, or geography. And the concept of an inclusive fertility benefit that included, you know, care and treatment for gay and lesbian couples who, you know, want access to either reciprocal IVF or adoption or gestational carrier care, that was kind of like on the fringe. I mean, that was really sort of like, you know, bleeding edge stuff. But now I think the category has evolved so quickly and so well that expectation that your fertility benefit should be inclusive of all employees and all people, regardless of age, race, sex, sexual orientation, gender identity, expression, marital status, or geography, is normal, right? And now that's table stakes. Mm-hmm. And so I'm really proud of sort of how we have entered the space and really lifted the conversation so that it's not just the ceiling of expectation gets higher for what a product should do, but the floor gets higher as well.
And what was the original reason why so many people were excluded? It had something to do with, like, you needed a medical diagnosis to qualify, right?
Yeah, and that's still very, very common. So, you know, the healthcare system is really set up to, you know, it's really good at treating disease. And so it would recognize the disease of infertility. And infertility as a medical diagnosis, as a disease, is the inability for two people of the opposite sex to achieve pregnancy after 6 to 12 months of unprotected intercourse under the supervision of a doctor. So it's a
with the doctor
really
in the room.
Yeah. So, I mean, you can imagine how, you know, that's a pretty high bar. Now, you know, people, there, of course, infertility diagnoses are more and more common. People have, you know, have infertility, but it's a really high bar to meet, and it's an impossible bar to meet for, you know, for same-sex couples or single intending parents or opposite sex couples who don't have a year or don't want to wait a year in order to access care.
So I'm curious, of the 150 million people who have employer sponsored healthcare, what percentage of those have any fertility coverage, and what does the average fertility coverage plan look like?
So, you know, there's different stats from different sources, but, you know, let's call it between 30 and 40% of employers will offer some sort of coverage for, like, basic diagnostics care. So the diagnosis requirements, so the diagnosis protocol, mm-hmm. for whether or not you have infertility, it's the ultrasound. If you're, you know, on the female side, it's the ultrasound, it's the lab work, and then it's the consultation with the doctor. You know, I think Fertility IQ is a great sort of resource to look at for folks who are interested in sort of looking at, like, what are the trend lines of how employers are adopting this just over the past, you know, 4 or 5 years. And what you'll see is an increase in expanding access to IVF so that there is no medical diagnosis required. There's also an increase in egg freezing, which was and still is a much smaller percentage of employers who will offer that as a benefit. But I think that is an area of huge acceleration and huge, huge potential in thinking about adding fertility benefits to basic healthcare. And Facebook is, you know, Facebook was very much a leader in this category. I'm sure both of you really remember that. Yeah. you know, when Cheryl, you know, when Facebook announced that they would cover egg freezing as a part of their health plans, it really moved the needle in terms of thinking about, okay, well, what is the rest of the economy going to do? And so I think that's some of the power of like early adopters and early movers and the influence on sort of other categories and the rest of the economy.
And who is actually paying for the egg freezing, let's say, because that is still considered a voluntary effort, right? And this move towards not needing a medical diagnosis and not seeing this as a disease, but as part of your options for, you know, having the most fulfilling life that you particularly want. So what's the financial background and how does Carrot play a role in helping a company that may want to compete with Facebook and offer egg freezing?
Yeah, so we work with companies to create financial plan designs so they can have, you know, we have large public companies as customers who provide $10,000 in benefits. We have private companies that offer $50,000, $100,000, $150,000 in benefits. And each of those Carrot dollars can be used for high quality fertility care without, without gates or, you know, or barriers. So if you are somebody who wants access to fertility preservation and egg freezing, you can use your Carrot benefit for that. And I think the flexibility of the plan gives employers a lot of opportunity to say, hey, this is applicable to many, many more people. So we're sort of opening it up to more of their employees. And then it gives employees opportunities to access different types of care that would otherwise be blocked.
So it's the employer who's funding all of this.
The employer's funding it, yeah.
How do you help them think about this investment and how they'll see the return?
Yeah, so our cost is about sort of for every dollar that you put in Carrot, you get $3 to $5 back.
That's amazing.
And the way that that's returned is through sort of managing for example, an IVF protocol where somebody who would otherwise transfer more than one embryo, right, is now transferring only one. And so for folks who may be listening and don't know, like transferring more than one embryo during an IVF cycle is risky because you could become pregnant with multiple births. So you could become pregnant with twins or with triplets. In this country and in many countries around the world, multiple gestation pregnancies are considered high risk. There's higher risk of miscarriage. There's higher risk of preterm. There's higher potential need for C-sections. There's higher probability that that a NICU event will happen. And so sort of what we do is we sort of manage that protocol and we ensure that the single transfers are happening way more often than the multiple transfers. So single pregnancies are happening way more often than multiple pregnancies. 47% of people who interact with Carrot for the first time in their IVF journey actually change their minds from, hey, I'm going to transfer two because twins is great and I get two for the price of one and why not? I'm here anyway. And they ultimately move towards an intention to transfer a single embryo, which means they have a higher chance of a healthy, right, single pregnancy. And so those are the types of things that we do when we talk to employers to think about, okay, here's how our product can help improve the member experience, but also really contain your costs. Employers in this country are really in a very unique position when compared to employers in other countries around the world. Like they are on the hook for healthcare. And healthcare is the most expensive thing that they will buy in any given year for any business. And so, you know, in a lot of ways, employers are really at the forefront and they are the innovators of healthcare, right? The solutions that they deploy, the tactics and the strategies that they implement will determine what is included as a part of healthcare, who has access to it, at what price, when, and how. And so, you know, our focus is really on working with employers and helping them understand that the cost of not implementing a fertility solution over time is actually much bigger than the investment for that company of implementing a fertility solution like Carrot.
And what about for fertility solutions that are purely optional, though? Like in the past, so for instance, when I did my egg freezing, I didn't go through insurance because it wasn't going to cover it. Twitter didn't have any benefit, so it was pure cash out of pocket. So you could, is this the competitive marketplace that we're in that you're saying, look, you can choose just not to offer this at all. But then you're not going to be competitive as an employer. And so if you're going to offer it, use us because we can make it the most efficient use of your dollars.
Yeah, I mean, you'll definitely be a step behind in terms of competing for talent, but you also expose your healthcare costs to a lot more risk over time, right? You mm-hmm. expose your healthcare budget to higher probability of a NICU event because of a multiple pregnancy. Mm. As you said, I mean, this is a perfect, your example is a perfect example because what employers have to grapple with is the fact that their employees, when they want IVF, they are going to go out and they are going to get it if they really want it. And if they have to pay for IVF themselves, that means the employer has no opportunity to, you know, be a part of that decision making. That the employer has no program or product that can help educate that member or that employee about, you know, single transfers versus multiple transfers, right? So the question mm-hmm. is like, does Twitter want Chloe out there doing, you know, IVF on her own, or, you know, does the employer want Carrot inside the picture helping to guide that member down the healthiest path?
Mm-hmm. That's really interesting. It's like you're using IVF and the risks around IVF as sort of the tip of the spear for broader fertility choices. Because you could look at egg freezing, for instance, as, you know, it's mm-hmm. purely optional. If, you know, fertility preservation, it's truly a choice. But you're saying, look, IVF, and when you do have employees, as all employers have, employees of childbearing age, the risks around childbearing, the costs will be borne by the employer no matter what. And so pull that into the tent. I can see the argument for that being really spot on. And then part of the Carrot package, though, is let's get the choice, this idea of actually building your fertility future with knowledge, data, and choice built in. I love that you're, you know, by packaging it all together, I'm sure there's economies of scale, and you're bringing this change, this cultural change, more quickly to the marketplace, which is really brilliant.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. What are some of the other areas of fertility that you're really excited about that can help improve the science, that can help bring some of these costs down, and mm-hmm. any areas that you're really excited about?
There's some interesting science in the pipeline around mitochondrial replacement therapy. There's been a lot of good work around ovarian tissue preservation versus freezing. You know, retrieving the egg and freezing the egg, mm-hmm. like actually freezing ovarian tissue, which has obviously a different dynamic and more eggs and more generative capabilities. But I think the biggest game changer for the whole picture is really like dramatic innovations at the embryology lab level.
Mm-hmm.
'Cause that would just fundamentally change the economics of this entire thing. If you could make the embryology lab less expensive, less manual, if you can apply AI, if you can figure out a way to read different embryos and choose the healthiest one without – embryology labs are wildly expensive. They're the most expensive piece of any fertility clinic by far. Mm-hmm. The human capital that goes behind that is also incredibly expensive, and it's why care is very expensive largely. And so I think there's some work being done around like on the embryology side with AI and machine learning and mm-hmm. really figuring out like, is there an embryology lab in a box, you know, option that can be built over time? I think if that were to be true, then it would change like a lot of things.
Yeah. You know, when I was going through IVF, I had no idea back. I mean, this was like 6-7 years ago, but I had no idea how much the quality of the embryologist really mm-hmm. mattered mm-hmm. in terms of how well the embryos fertilize or how well the eggs fertilized, and then, you know, kind of what the ultimate success rates are. And there's some really interesting new companies that are kind of in like the robotics, AI, mm-hmm. machine learning space, where it's like, can we do training models on the best embryologists in the world
right.
and replicate that?
Right.
So you could start to see mm. some pretty significant, you know, increases in terms of fertilization rates and success rates overall.
Yeah, I think the space. I mean, we're at the dawn of what this category is going to be ultimately, and I think to you know even Chloe, to your point about adding egg freezing as a benefit, I think in the future it will be a very clear sort of cost savings lever as well. Mm-hmm. Because, you know, 25-year-old frozen eggs are healthier or more likely to be chromosomally normal than 40 or 45-year-old eggs. And so it in the future, people might decide to use frozen eggs not because of because they're optimizing for health, right? Because they're optimizing mm-hmm. for using like the highest quality reproductive material that they have access to of their own, which is, you know, my eggs from 10 years ago, versus trying to get pregnant through intercourse.
Which leads me to my question. This is such an interesting role you play. How much does ethics, I mean, there are ethical questions all over the place, right? Mm-hmm. And ethics is a huge part of this. Like, I know you're focused on just making the choice available, mm-hmm. and then I'm sure you're looking to the ethicists to help define the boundaries of where, like, for instance, for embryologists, at what level and what level of information beyond chromosomal health are we looking for? Like gender selection, right? Like, mm-hmm. how do you think about that? What's your role? Where do you look for insights in that space?
Yeah, so, you know, we are we're not entirely responsible, but we're also can't abdicate responsibility because we're part of the community and part of the picture now and increasingly a bigger and bigger part of it, right? So I think, you know, for us and for me, there are, as you said, there are ethical, like ethics committees within these professional bodies of reproductive endocrinologists, within the professional organizations, ASRM and others, that think about this full time, right? They think about this and they recommend best practices to providers and to clinics about what is and what is not okay. We track those very closely. And we also, you know, we take a hard line that we don't provide coverage for treatments that are still experimental, right? And they're experimental for a whole host of reasons, whether it's, you know, the ethics haven't caught up yet or really the clinical trials haven't caught up yet or whatever it is, like whatever the reason is that it's experimental, like mitochondrial replacement therapy or whatever, we don't provide coverage for that. Mm-hmm. What sort of ethical position do we want to take on who has access to this? So again, that's why we were like very adamant from day one that LGBT people would have access to this, right? And like that was a line that we were going to draw for ourselves and that we would present to employers as a default option for how this product works. And so it's definitely a fast changing space. Like we don't cover stem cell therapy treatments. We don't cover, you know, obviously any CRISPR related things or anything that is sort of at that frontier. That's not where we are.
Do you allow employers to change the plan to exclude any categories that, you would prefer to see as their default part of the plan?
Yeah. So, I mean, we do have some employers who actually give a bigger benefit to people who are pursuing surrogacy, right? So they will actually give more financial coverage for the treatment and care of surrogacy because it is such an outsized, expensive procedure. For folks who don't know, I mean, surrogacy is like $100,000 plus, easily $200,000, depending on sort of what your path is, right? And so in that context, I sort of understand it. We've made accommodations for that in the product because it's rational, right? A $25,000 benefit doesn't have the same impact for somebody going through egg freezing. It doesn't have the same impact for somebody as going through IVF as somebody who is going through gestational carrier care. So we've made accommodations like that. We have a default version of the product, which is a standard sort of here's how it works. And we try not to deviate from that very much.
That makes sense though. That sounds more like different paths to achieving a family are have different expenses based on your underlying biology, right? Mm-hmm. If you're two men and you need to go through surrogacy, that is more expensive than a heterosexual couple who can pursue IVF or mm-hmm. egg freezing. So that does make sense. It's an interesting space because in some ways people might look at you and Carrot and think, gosh, the ethics of this, you're pushing such frontiers and such boundaries. And this is an example of a technologist or somebody with a tech background coming in and engaging with this space that we may not be as fully prepared or as, you know, as deeply committed to or understand. And yet, I actually think this is a much safer, great model of how technology and ethics and science can play together compared to, say, social media, mm-hmm. where without, you know, this is an area what we've learned with the tribalism of American culture and politics and how much social media has played a role in that, how technology and ethics have to be hand in hand. And we will often, in many cases, not be able to predict the ethical implications of our technology. In your case, we can see, right? We've had science fiction for, you know, a century around where we're headed and can kind of understand some of the implications. But for things like social media, we were, I think, at first understandably blind, then willfully blind, and now, you know, in a hot mess trying to figure out how to bring the ethics in and understand, you know, what, you know, how does it push up against free speech and the Constitution and community? It's fascinating. But I think it's, you know, for those who think that, you know, fertility is an ethical frontier, oh no, we have them all over the place in technology. And
that's right.
What Tammy's doing is, you know, is really, you know, a playbook for how we should think about it.
Well, I have often said that, you know, so Chloe has three daughters. I have two daughters. And I've said as soon as my daughters turn like 20, I will give them the option of freezing their eggs. And they will have that fertility savings account. And I know, Chloe, you've talked about the same.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That'll be normal by the time they're their age.
Yes.
You know, that yes. will be very, very normal. Yeah.
So a little bit of advice from you, Tammy. I still have, I think, 20 mm-hmm. High-quality mm-hmm. eggs that I'm spending $675 a year to keep frozen because I can't quite – I don't know what to do with them. What should I do with them? Like, do I – I mean, I'd like to donate them, I think.
Yeah.
But it's fascinating, you know, to be like, okay, my, you know, these little eggs going out into the world and will I stay connected to them? Will I know who they become? It's just – it's only my genetic material.
Mm-hmm.
How do you, and just to end on a very futuristic note, how do yeah. you counsel or think about that issue?
I think, and I remember talking about this, like, you know, we will all ultimately be part of this conversation of developing new norms around fertility. And one of the important norms, legal norms, what are the financial norms? Like, what do these transactions look like? People like to say donate, but really what we mean is we mean sell, right? People aren't comfortable saying sell. So we say words like donate. And so I think we have to rethink some of these norms, right? And build that infrastructure, build that world, build those norms so that these kinds of transactions can be done with confidence, right? And with a sense of safety. And I think that's mm-hmm. what's really kind of missing. And we're still in the early stages of that is how do you let go of your reproductive material with confidence, knowing that it will be handled, right? That it will be handled in a safe way, that it will get to the intended recipient and that person will act responsibly and that provider and that doctor. I mean, there's so many different pieces in this chain, but it requires a norm structure, right? That we all have to be responsible for. And I do think that if we do it right, and I think we have an opportunity to, then, you know, people who need reproductive material will be able to access it. People who have surplus reproductive material will be able to supply it. And I think the world will be better off if that is true.
Yes, I agree.
Agreed. You know, before COVID, when we used to have hashtag angels events, we always said it wasn't a hashtag angels event unless we talked about egg freezing. So we're excited.
That's right.
We're excited that we get to bring this to the pod and you're the perfect guest. And we are so proud of how much progress you've made over the last 4 or 5 years of company building. It's been phenomenal to watch and cheer from the sidelines.
Well, I'm so proud to be in this cohort. I mean, the angels really know how to pick them. You have an incredible portfolio of high performing companies of which I am proud to be a part. So thank you for having me.
Our pleasure.
Awesome. And, you know, we like to end the pod with just one question.
Mm-hmm.
And so curious, and we're putting you on the spot a little bit here, but who's one person that really stands out that has been an amazing mentor or support network for you?
You know, the Evernote crew has been incredible. And I will say that sort of having that little mafia has been a huge support. They've all reformed, reorganized into different companies and some at All Turtles and some as independents. But I mean, I have a lot of former Evernote folks who work at Carrot, who advise the company, who are friends of the company. And so I think, you know, if I could give a piece of advice to younger people, it's like pick where you're going to work based on like who you're around. Because like you never know, like your colleagues today could be your co-founders tomorrow. They could be employees. They could be early team members. So just pick the highest quality people that you can find.
That's great advice. I love that. We talk about being part of the Twitter mafia all the time. And it's just like, even though there were so many incredible things that came out of our experience of working at Twitter, like, to me, by far the best was hashtag angels.
Yeah.
Like I formed, you know, amazing close relationships with these five other women. You know, we founded something together and we continue to get to work together and collaborate and conspire and like dream big together. And it's just been such an amazing thing to come out of that experience.
Totally. But, you know, I will say it's so fun. You know, being here with you both, you were the first money to hit my bank account. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's just really fun to continue to imagine the future forward with both of you. We're not there yet. We're not anywhere near there. But I think there's a lot more clarity around how exciting this category is. But you both were definitely, you know, among the first to see it.
Yeah. Awesome. Tammy, thank you so much.
Thank you. Have a great day. Tammy.
And that's a wrap. Thank you for listening. To keep up with Tammy, you can follow her on Twitter. She's at Tammy Sun. Next up on the pod, we'll sit down with Claire Hughes Johnson, the COO of Stripe. If you're enjoying the pod, please give us a rating or leave us a review. It helps for people to find us. Or just talk to us on Twitter to give us feedback. We're at #angels. The Hashtag Angels podcast is a production of H Industries. This episode was produced and edited by Matt Herrero, and our theme music was composed by Toby Forsman of Whipsong Music. Thank you for listening. We'll see you next week.